It's July 20th, 2017. You're listening to the Fancy Ramen Podcast, Omake, covering episode 7, 8, and 9 of Yusha Yoshihiko. Before we get into the summaries, did you guys feel better about these three episodes overall?
Actually, I'd say that besides episode 7, I don't know if I really enjoyed... Well, I know I probably didn't really enjoy 8 all that much. I could have skipped it, which is in which teen idolship is threatened. And then I was like okay with episode 9. So I think that maybe some of the previous episodes were funnier. Though I won't diss 7. I really enjoyed episode in which Merib-san is only worth 5 gold.
Yeah, episode 8 in which teen idolship is threatened. I feel like maybe there are some jokes that don't necessarily hit us as well.
Right.
I was also, we'll get to some of the weird surprises that could have been great gags, or like the lack of gags that could have happened there. In episode 9, in which Merib-san learns Crickle, it was really dry for the most part. There were some good jokes here and there, but it honestly felt like there was more story to this episode, and in a series that really doesn't need to have story, I guess.
Right. Its strongest point, I think, has been just the skits in general. I mean, they don't even have to necessarily follow a very like cohesive narrative, and I'm fine with the skits.
I'm right there with you, and yeah, I could have did without the teen idol one. Merib learning Crickle. I like Crickle. That's a good spell. And the episode 7?
Is
that the one we all like? Yeah, 7 was just amazeballs.
That's the 5-floor tower, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
that one was amazeballs.
I wouldn't even say it was amazing, but let's go over it. The one thing that does surprise me about episode 7 is it does not start off with a bandit or random encounter. Instead, we learn that Merib has learned his most ridiculous spell concepts. Which the translation for it, at least at our group that was doing it for Scott and I, was polycopene. Is that right?
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's I can't remember the first chemical, but it's a poly compound mixed with lycopene, and it's a blood cleaner, or at least that's how Merib pitches it. But really, it's just a healthy dose of fruits and vegetables.
And
it's polyphenol. I just remembered. It's polyphenol and lycopene, two healthy components found in grapes and tomatoes, respectively.
that's what it was.
I sometimes don't know what to expect from Donjo. It sounds like he actually believes these spells work. Most of the spells work, or all of the spells, maybe even.
I don't think Donjo's a very doubtful man. I think he takes most things at face value and rolls with it.
Pretty much, as he said, stated, I'm at that age where I should be worried about my health. Do you want to cast that on me too?
Yeah,
he really he doesn't have any skepticism, so I think he's willing to just roll with whatever. And I mean, even if it's not an effective spell, it might as well be worth trying, since the worst thing that can happen is you get a extra healthy dosage of polyphenol and lycopene.
Or, you know, death.
Yeah, a little later on we may find out just what could happen if you ask someone to cast a spell on you. but before that, they consult with Buddha again, who tells... and I think this is the episode where they do that by having Murasaki ask for Buddha in a very, quote-unquote cutesy fashion.
Buddha, please. Indeed. Yeah, that is the one for sure.
And Buddha tells them they must find the dragon shield. And we see a little more RPG town humor when they make it to the next town, in which townsfolk do not really respond to them, but just say their scripted lines.
Wait, you're going to skip over the fact that the Buddha responded back in a cutesy tone too?
Oh,
at least mocking
at
first, but I don't know why that was so funny. He even did the little cat paw, curled his fist. Yeah.
It seemed like his demeanor was more almost like, wait, why am I doing this? Now I'm angry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they learn that Mr. Ladman has the demon shield, and he's willing to give it to them, but the party must gather rent from his supposedly killer and dangerous tenants that refuse to pay.
So I'll say that skit when they were actually talking to him was my favorite skit out of this entire episode.
Oh, you mean specifically when they're talking about how they could just walk away with it?
Yeah, when it was like, you know, we could just come back and steal it later. And it's like, I'm right here. You're not supposed to say that. And then Danjo's like, we can just take it now.
And run.
And Yoshihiko's just like, he hands his sword over to Melov and picks it up. And everyone's just sitting there awkwardly like, huh.
Yeah, I know. The fact that he just waits there with it in his hands and seems to deliberate on whether he's going to actually bolt or not is what really like puts the pressure on the joke and makes it even funnier, especially when he gets stopped as soon as he starts moving. He's like, come on, enough of that.
I'd like to think that it was kind of like a play on the fact that in RPGs, all that it really takes to create your own quote-unquote quiet zone is to turn away from a character you're talking to talk to your party.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know if you've specifically seen this type of thing happen before, but I feel like the show, if it is indeed doing that, I feel like the show does a good job in contrasting between characters that are completely NPC-like to other ones that are like more believable and interact or make fun of the RPG tropes just as much.
Yeah, I think all their main characters don't follow the whole like fixed dialogue or anything like that. And that is what kind of sells the joke. Otherwise, you know, this boss would have been, or Mr. Ladman would have been a static NPC and would have offered the quest. And if he weren't responsive, they could have just walked out with it. And so I feel like whenever they're getting issued a quest by somebody or they're interacting with someone that's really relevant to the, I guess, event of that episode, they never seem to follow that like really rigid and strict NPC dialogue and rules like that.
They've got far more complex coding, you would say?
Yeah.
You could say that, yeah. They've got a better script to work from.
Well, the next RPG trope is pointed out by Merib when they get to the pagoda, I think is what they called it.
Pagoda?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Okay. Pagoda. And it's a 5-floor tower, with each tower supposedly getting stronger and stronger. In
each level of the tower?
Each level. Jesus, I'm off my game. The first floor, I did not necessarily get the reference they were making, but it's a...
I think he was just a bully.
Okay, that's what I assumed. Jaitan is this character that wears an orange sweater with a white stripe across the middle. And I just kind of assumed the whole glasses skit or scene where he gives the glasses to Yoshihiko, I was assuming that was just pointing out like, oh, now Yoshihiko is the stand-in for the nerdy kid and Jaitan is the bully.
So when they first actually show Jaitan, I was thinking they were going to do something like Number 4 from Codename Kids Next Door.
Is Number 4 the Asian or...
Nope, he's the white blonde kid with the orange hoodie.
Isn't he Australian? Or he sounds Australian?
No, that's Number 1.
Oh, okay.
Well, no. Number 4 is still Australian because he's Wallaby Wally Beatles.
Oh, yeah, you're right. He is the Australian one. My bad.
Number one is British. Yeah, exactly.
So my first thought was, oh, maybe he's supposed to be Number 4. But then he was being a lot meaner than Number 4 would be. And I was like, okay. Codename Kids Next Door.
It was a good show, actually. I really enjoyed it.
Back to the bully
being
mean to Yoshihiko.
I'm trying to remember if there was anything else that really shines in that portion, but I like the other floors so much more.
The only thing that was about that floor was they almost lost.
Yeah, they almost lost, except for, if not for Jaitan's mother coming in.
Yeah. As, what's her name puts it, it was a lucky punch.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I can appreciate more after playing Persona.
That's such a good move.
I mean, I figure it's got to be a move that's common enough in other RPGs for that kind of reference, but maybe they were making a... Neil, do you know any games that have Lucky Punch besides Persona? It's the only game I know of that has that.
Other SMT games, and I think it's also... I could be wrong, and it could be something different when it's in Japanese, but that's also a move in Pokemon, I'm pretty sure.
It is.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But I don't know if it's in any other games. And again, I don't know if the Lucky Punch in the SMT universe is the same, like, in its origin as the Lucky Punch in Pokemon, because, you know, it could be just one casual translation between two Japanese terms.
Maybe. I've got a feeling that if it's in Pokemon, it's probably a high critical hit rate. Yeah, so anyway, I guess moving forward, though, since this floor was kind of boring, I think it made the next floor even funnier for me, because that was the... Was that the guy who went ahead and he... What's the right word?
He hypnotized...
He charmed Murasaki, and then he had to go fetch his single arrow every time he missed.
And before fetching his arrow, he calls time out. And Marib, obviously being like the straight man, so to speak, in a lot of these scenes, surprisingly, is like, wait, what? We're not going to time out. But Yoshihiko is always, you know, so I don't even know what the word I would use, but he's
Yoshihiko
so...
Yoshihiko seems to get...
He's courteous
as this show progresses.
See, I think he's always been dumb. I think he's just extremely courteous. So when an enemy asks for something, he, like, his nice guy heroic attitude always, you know, lets him fall for it.
He wants to help everyone out. So yeah, he calls a timeout, and Meadow's just like, no, he's walking right past us, guys. He's grabbing the arrow. Yep, he grabbed the arrow. You just gonna let him grab the arrow? Okay. Don't what now he's loading the arrow. Now he's gonna fire at us.
He's gonna fire again. And this scene in particular kind of makes me feel like Danjo's character is intentionally plain at times, because he's really just here to follow Yoshihiko's orders, I think, in half of the scenes.
No, I could see that, because right after that, Yoshihiko was trying to help him get the thing, and he's like, Danjo, help. And Danjo's like, Okay, I'll help.
This floor is ultimately conquered when Yoshihiko snaps the arrow or cuts the arrow in two on the third shot, and we move on from there to the third floor inhabited by Suzuki, which is notably a rather feminine name, as Marib points out.
Yep, and then it turns out he's a mage, and Marib's just all up on his high horse. It's like, oh, you know one spell? Huh.
You only need to know one when it's a total party killer.
When Yoshihiko asks for the spell to be cast on him, it turns out to be Zaraki, and it kills off the entire party.
Yep, and they said it's a direct line from Dragon Quest, actually.
We might be watching the same fan sub then, in fact.
I would imagine so.
So after the party wipe, Yoshihiko awakens in a church, which is like total... Well, not just Dragon Quest, but a lot of RPGs have that church state where instead of having a game over where you have to load again, you just wake up in a church and your party is dead and you have to resurrect them with money, in which we come to the title learning that Danjo is 90 gold to resurrect, Murasaki 50, and Marib is 5. And maybe the best part about this shtick is that he doesn't even point out the crazy discrepancy in values. Yoshihiko, that is.
Yeah, no, they go with it. I mean, it probably is normal if you think about how effective Melib's been.
I could see that.
Though, I guess Murasaki's kind of undervalued, because she's the one who keeps learning new skills and abilities, which seem to help them out. I'm not saying that Pig-a-Nose and Sweets haven't come in handy once or twice, but Murasaki's got the most effective, I guess, special abilities so far out of any of these characters.
You know, stunning people and the sneak attack one. She's got the sneak attack one already, right? Yeah.
She's got the sneak attack. She's got the drunken eyes. She's got big eyes. They're all eye moves, apparently.
until episode 9, I think, right?
Yeah.
You're right, yeah.
So he has to go and hunt down a king slime, I think would be the enemy. I could be wrong with that, but it's basically just a giant blue slime with a crown.
And he asks him how much he's worth before he kills him.
Yeah.
How much are you worth? I'm probably worth about, what did he say, 150 golds?
132.
That's what he said.
And so he comes back with only 142, which is unfortunately 3 gold less than what he needs to resurrect the entire party.
But good news, there's a partial revive.
And in the next scene, we find out, after getting apologies from Suzuki and getting his rent, because Suzuki, again, is not actually mean or anything. He just, you know, went along with Yoshihiko to cast the spell.
And he just literally forgot to pay his rent. Just slipped his mind. And he said, I'm surprised it was super effective as he was walking away. It's like, I'm surprised it was so effective.
We find out in that scene that Danjo has been revived partially out of the three. Yoshihiko, and I understand this decision too, because he's thinking Danjo's so strong, so maybe like at half he's still useful. But he just seems to have reverted to his soulless, quote-unquote, state, where he has that feminine side to him.
Until he wills himself back to full resurrection.
Which is after our fourth floor, if I'm not mistaken, inhabited by Tarata, a television-esque salesman.
Yeah, he goes down pretty quick. I was surprised how much he was willing to throw in on his deal. He just keeps going. He's like, I've got a second TV in the room. Shoot, I'll sell you the floorboards. Come on, make the deal.
Oh, and this month's rent. I mean, and my back rent.
Yeah, which was the best part. I also enjoyed that. So Danjo's still his more effeminate personality during this. And I think when the sale gets to be that good, he's like, oh my God, take it, take it. This deal is too good to be true. So he sort of comes in handy by being partially resurrected for that scene.
I almost thought that he, when he said take it, that he meant it in the aggressive way, like, you know, attack now, but it's hard to interpret, right? Because it's not like he handed over the money. Yoshihiko instead used his beckoning sword and cut the guy or put him to sleep.
That's true, yeah.
But he didn't go to sleep before giving an ominous message to the gang that the guy on the fifth floor, he once killed a bunch of bears with his bare hands. He's the strongest of them all. He's lived in that house for 20 years? 40 years.
Yeah,
which one?
Either 30 or 40 years.
It was 40 years. It was 30 years ago that he actually killed the 10 bears.
Because we soon find that he is now an old man and really can't do anything.
And Yoshihiko is determined on adding him to his useless party.
That he is, after he is bested by, I'm terrible with names.
By
Murasaki.
A bad back? Oh, yeah.
She kicks him over and Yoshihiko goes to his side. He's like, I've been bested. Figured once I got beaten, once I was defeated, I would pay my back rent.
After accomplishing their task, they get the dragon shield, which Yoshihiko conveniently puts in their wagon.
Okay. That was lovely.
It was
dumb,
really
but lovely.
Joke.
Where the shield just leaves his hands and floats up into the sky.
Yeah. It's like Link's magical hat, you know, where he keeps all of his equipment.
Is that the justification?
Is the hat?
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever heard that, but that's hilarious.
Oh, you've never heard of Link's magical hat? Yeah, because, you know, he's got all that stuff on him that he can, that you never see until he pulls
where
it out.
Where is it? You're right.
In other games, you upgrade his pouches, though, so you can get that extra space.
Is it like a magical pouch that then makes things smaller as they go into the pouch?
I think we're just ignoring the physics behind actually stuffing some of these items in. Because it's like, I don't see a bow on him, but somehow he's able to, you know, wedge it out of some pocket or pouch.
He does it with the quickness, too. Got full quick draw on. As the shield floats away and joins in jumps into their inventory, what's his name?
We get another Buddha scene in which he makes a flat chest joke to Murasaki again. Or I shouldn't say again. He does it for the first time this episode. And Murasaki protests by saying that they've used a flat chest joke 3 times in 2 episodes now. And Buddha apologizes.
Oh, I think I've misread flatty once or twice as fatty. And I'm like, wow, they're really going for it, huh? I mean, I think either insult's, you know, a little mean, but I was confused. And I was like, I don't remember them calling her fat anytime recently.
Nope, just flat.
That makes more sense. Yeah. Though, is insufficient really an insult?
Yes.
Yeah, very
yes,
much.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
We also learn that they must get the Philosopher's Mail, or breastplate, armor, whatever you want to call it, mail, M-A-I-L.
I think it is mail, yeah.
Yep.
And in closing, we learn that Hisa is now an escapee prisoner.
Sweet.
She's got a way more exciting life than anybody else in this show.
Gone through several stages of her life. But before we can talk about episode 8, Hisa, in our opening scene and return to our bandit random encounters, the bunny bandit returns.
This time without his gun, because he doesn't need it.
Catch a break.
No, he cannot.
As we learn, when his wife has discovered his titty magazines, and he's ultimately defeated, being forced to seek forgiveness from his wife, groveling with his head centimeters from the ground.
And doesn't Yoshihiko also tell him that he could go a little lower?
Yes.
I think Murasaki says that, right? Oh, no, you guys are probably...
Yoshihiko says it, and Murasaki's like, sisterhood, girl power.
I know, yeah. When they leave... I don't think she necessarily like pounds a fist with her, but she's just like, yeah, you keep it up. The struggle's real.
Yep.
It's like a fist bump or a pump, like, you know, when you do it in the air.
Yes.
But that was maybe the high point of this episode for me.
Yep.
As we go into the Dharma Shrine, where the characters get job changes, and assumedly Danjo becomes a martial artist. We don't technically know that or see that. And we also...
So he does?
What's that?
Danjo does change his job?
We supposedly hear he does, or at least he claims he wants to do that. And he's ahead of Yoshihiko as well, so we don't see him actually make the request, but Mera becomes a priest, and I don't recall what Murasaki was saying as she runs over to Yoshihiko.
She wanted to become a mage like Merab so she could learn
actual
useful
abilities.
Spells. Yeah. And she runs over to Yoshihiko just in time for him to, instead of becoming a warrior, which in hindsight, I guess, since they didn't know it gets rid of your other class, he would have lost the hero status anyway. He becomes a pop star.
Well,
teen idol.
I should know. I think it might only apply to the hero job in particular, because maybe Mirab is just talking out of his ass, but later on he says
he's a priest and a mage. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that too. And they don't mention it for the others. But then he also throws away that job immediately.
Yep. As we are now on to Yoshihiko trying his darndest at being a pop star, kind of, not really. He just can't get away.
Not until he sees his fans' glowing faces, and then he's all in. But it's too late. He didn't practice hard enough. His heart just wasn't in it.
And we got a second hero.
Pongy, or PJ. He was a level 99 goof-off that decided to become a hero because it was there was an opening for it.
And someone said it was really cool.
Yeah. And what do you mean I have to trek through mud?
I like these boots.
Before we go any further, I do want to point out that the reason Murasaki is able to find a lead on the philosopher's mail inside of a well is because she says that Yoshihiko says, always check inside the well.
Which, and the one time she does.
Yeah, which is thing as well. Like that made me so happy. Maybe that is actually the best thing for me in this. But as we see that PJ obviously is not fit to be a hero, this entire running gimmick, I'm thinking to myself, man, PJ would probably make a great teen idol.
Oh, yeah.
I thought he was totally going to swap. He even had the outfit for it, almost. I'm assuming this follows your point earlier, Neil, that like there were jokes that I think they could have easily capitalized on that they didn't, that was almost surprising.
Wait, like the lulls?
Yeah, and PJ swapping was definitely one. Like you thought at the end they would have encountered each other and then traded jobs. But no. PJ just gets bored.
And what does he become?
A womanizer.
Mm.
He doesn't establish that, right?
No, he just throws away the hero status. I don't think he actually picks up anything else. Maybe he reverts to being a goof-off.
Yeah, a level 99 goof-off again.
It's a high-class goof-off.
Oh, so as we alluded to before, Yoshihiko ends up getting fired from his teen idol role, so he ends up becoming a hero again. And they get the philosopher's mail. It's all pretty uneventful for me. But we do find that Hisa has gone even further in her exciting lifestyle by becoming a presumably mob boss.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's definitely it. She's the head of her own little crime syndicate. She's even got yukata? Is that what they call it? She's got the traditional garb that a mob boss would be wearing, at least a female one, if Kill Bill is any indication for me.
That's where I've learned all my Japanese culture from.
Exactly.
I kind of want to watch that series now. It's three of them, right? It doesn't matter.
There's only two.
Oh.
It's worth it. I think it's entertaining. You can't go in expecting a serious movie. That's all I should say.
It's serious in its own way.
Yeah.
Just like every Tarantino movie. And speaking of Tarantino movies, I was just talking to someone about Inglourious Basterds and how awesome that was.
So. Yeah, I didn't honestly enjoy that movie that much at first. Like, I didn't dislike it, but I thought it was pretty blasé compared to some of the other stuff I've seen. And I think every time I watch it, I gain a little extra appreciation, like a new appreciation for it.
So should I watch that movie a second time then?
I mean, if you felt like it was pretty lackluster the first time, you might as well give it a shot. Because the second time I watched it, I was like, whoa, I missed a lot. Or like there was a lot that I could have appreciated that I didn't really recognize at the time.
Brad Pitt might have been because
I watched it sleepy, which it turns out Cookie and I have now figured out that watching things while sleepy does not do you justice.
Not at all. Episode 9, our opening scene is with Scar the Bandit. I'm blanking now. It's a type of Japanese performance art or theatrical art.
I almost said kabuki, but that doesn't make sense. You know, it's the samurai that you always seen. It's got the flower print behind him, and he does the head turn thing. Oh, I love that.
The very like heavily enunciated, methodic delivery of lines. With the music, like that very specific music backing to it.
Are we talking? We're almost talking about Yusuke from Persona 5. Flowery background, head turns, stoic samurai.
Oh, but it's totally his persona. Like that's what it embodies, that type of acting, I think.
Yeah, no, totally. That's what I'm saying.
Kabuki.
Yeah, I don't know the proper term for it, so.
Kabuki.
I'll defer to you. If kabuki's it, then kabuki it is.
But isn't kabuki's, like, doesn't that
Japanese
involve...
Japanese theater?
But does that not involve very specific face painting?
Yeah, I thought it had certain face painting and...
Yep. Men as women. It's mainly just the theatrical part of it.
Gotcha.
Gives me the main thing. I was Googling Kabuki as I was talking about it to make sure.
Oh, okay. I'll defer to Google.
Well, so
Google knows all.
So Scar is also joined with his fan base of women that
his
all adore him.
Fan base.
Yes, current. Because after Danjo eventually slays him after tiring of his dancing, his fan base turns on him and then becomes enamored with Danjo.
And then Danjo quickly accepts the fan base as his own and wants to keep them.
Poor Danjo. Forced to live an isolated life.
Wait, did they say that he couldn't bring them? I thought they said that it was fine.
No, yeah. No.
In fact, Yoshihiko is like, very adamant. He just says no very strongly, and you can see the passion in his eyes. Like, he's obviously jealous.
Yeah, he's super jelly. Jealous.
So I'll admit, like, this episode after 8, I had, like, checked out in a way I was not prepared to have. So my notes aren't great. But we learn that they need to get the Ring of Life.
I'm sorry, the way you just mentioned how you checked out, just, that kills me, thanks. I also checked out.
I was going to say, it also sounds really familiar with my experience.
Uh-oh. Yep.
Well, I can say what I remember is we haven't talked about the fireside discussion yet, where Marib goes about explaining Crickle and the effectiveness of multiplying Crickle, and Murasaki learns her like little draining confusion dance, correct? That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So
which
I did enjoy.
Which they call Hell Disco.
Hell Disco. Yes. That's right. Hell Disco. I really did enjoy that Mella explained, at least, that, you know, at 1, you might just be tempted to put on a cardigan, but at 100, who knows? Who knows what could happen?
At 1,000,
you already need a parka at 50.
At 1,000 in a cold climate, if you're not a polar bear or something, you might even die.
Just like, so I wonder what his mana pool is like, because
that's exactly what I was thinking. Can he cast it 100 times? And how much is the mana cost? Is it just like, I bet all his spells, because they're so weak and ineffective, cost like a point?
Because he can only use Pygnosis once, but Crickle, we saw him use it on Murasaki like right at the very end there, like at least 5 times.
Yeah, he hit her 5 times in a row, and that was after using it on Yoshihiko and Danjo.
I love Danjo's reaction to it. I'm a little warm. Do you mind casting it on me? Crickle. Ah, that's pleasant.
Yes, this is actually pretty nice. And they didn't learn their lesson whatsoever from episode 7, in which you don't ask someone to just cast a spell on you immediately. I'm wondering if the joke will come back at all.
So before we get to their encounter with the quote-unquote devil priest that they're seeking out because of the fairy queen or whomever tells them that he stole the Ring of Life, they encounter a centaur, a minotaur, well, kind of minotaur. They also encounter a human with a cow udder, a raccoon-headed human who has guns, and a killer squirrel. I figured we just blast through these. Did you guys have any highlights from those encounters?
I didn't understand what was going on besides maybe like a sped up encounter where they ran into those bandits who had the, the cow udder and the bull horns, and they just skipped through it. Like, it didn't really show much. And then they
did a couple of highlight pictures and then Japanese text or whatever text.
Exactly, that we can't read, so I assumed it was just over and done with. But I saw the squirrel and was really disappointed, thinking, oh no, they're just going to pull the koala joke again. And then they did, and I continued to be disappointed. Because it still just wasn't funny, I guess.
I do like that the fact that Murasaki did call out that this is exactly like the koala.
Right. It didn't help them at all, but they at least recognize their failure.
So I'm pretty sure those highlight screens with the red kanji and hiragana on it were basically just saying something along the lines of, you know, like, and the battle ended and the heroes were triumphant or something along those lines. I did really like Rascal, their encounter with Rascal, the raccoon-headed man. Because when they when they handed him his gun, he went over to water instinctually to wash it.
And that's a raccoon behavior, correct?
Yeah, but like not necessarily for an item of any like kind. If you give a raccoon food, or if a raccoon finds food, the raccoon washes it off first before he eats it. There's actually a great video where a person gives a raccoon cotton candy, and the raccoon proceeds to wash it, and it dissolves in the water as he's washing it.
Oh, no.
Poor raccoon.
I'll have to show you that. It's fantastic.
Actually, if you put in raccoon washing cotton candy is the first thing to pop up. It's obviously got some popularity. It does look really sad. Like, where did it go?
Wait, I think I found the whole clip of it. It's 1:09 long.
Holy balls, that cotton candy dissolves super fast.
Yeah, it is just sugar.
But that was like, oh my goodness, this 1:09 clip is in Japanese and adorable.
Yeah, so anywho, the raccoon bit was good. I appreciated that. Was there anything else from the encounters that were good?
I mean, so we find out when they get to the home of the mountain priest, is it?
Yeah, that's what all of the encounters or their animal hybrids, chimeras, have been calling the devil priest, is actually the mountain priest.
Yeah, and we find out after they defeat the mountain priest later that he's actually just the mountain priest and not a devil priest at all. So does that mean that they just attacked a bunch of strangers or like innocent people on the way up to attack this also innocent mountain priest?
I think that is a plot hole that they were perfectly fine with leaving in. But you could justify by saying that the mountain priest is a man that wants his solitude and
does horrible experiments to humans.
Yeah, I mean, regardless,
and has cult-like followers.
I guess the mountain priest is still inherently evil in some extent because he is making these abominations.
Who does he think he is? God?
I mean, I guess he is some form of a lesser god.
Makes sense. He is the guardian deity of the mountain. The thing that really caught me off guard once we found out that the mountain priest was the mountain priest and the fairy was actually a demon, the fact that Yoshihiko could only see the two little girl fairies. And it, only because he was so pure of heart, as Mello turned to the camera and said, does that mean the rest of us aren't pure of heart?
Oh, that's a really good point. Because are those fairies actually fairies, or were they demons all along? Or are they, when I say demons. Were they actually fairies, does that mean that they are twisted or tainted fairies? Like corrupt fairies?
That is correct, because they are directly under the fairy queen, as she's like, thanks for taking care of those two girls. Because, piggyback rides.
So that means that Yoshihiko is, in fact, not the purest, but actually the most corrupt, or could mean.
I mean, we've kind of been able to see that as Yoshihiko has either been disoriented or had his soul removed or thought about his career as a teen idol. It turns out Yoshihiko is not a particularly heroic personality.
And he's the only one that can't see Buddha as well.
Yeah.
You can see these fairies, but you can't see Buddha. And we can all see Buddha, but you can't see these fairies.
I mean, yeah. I'm not betting that he's the Demon King yet, but he hasn't really shown himself to be the most stand-up hero.
And once Lady Polon becomes her demon form after putting on the ring, she's defeated because the ring did not change size with her form. And
how come it didn't grow?
Yeah, and her finger becomes this bright red color as it loses circulation, giving enough time for Yoshihiko to destroy him. Not sure if it matters there. And as we learn at the end, they have all the items necessary to fight the Demon King. They just need a way to get to the Demon King. So
which is conveniently translated from something to vagueness.
Yeah, our fan sub did not translate his the Buddha's weird accent in that final scene.
I don't think it was supposed to.
Yeah, I figured that the translation left the Japanese because to a Japanese speaker, he was supposed to also be like vaguely unintelligible.
But then wouldn't there also be a point to just putting an English subtitle because there's a hiragana subtitle or Japanese subtitle?
I don't know.
Maybe they just got lazy.
Another plot hole.
Either way, there's a magic carpet, a boat, go east, and Yoshihiko's sister.
Yeah, Hisa is a princess? I wasn't really sure what to take from that.
I was thinking she went from just like a low-level mob boss to like the mob boss.
Isn't she wearing like a white dress, though?
She mm-hmm. seemed like she was a lot more regal at that point.
That's the perfect word, I think. Regal.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know what her position is, but she seems to have transitioned from mob boss to, like, noble. And, I mean, none of her transitions have really made too much sense chronologically, so I wasn't really also worrying about how she can go from running a crime syndicate to being a noble.
Sounds, yeah. Yeah.
Good spinoff series. What the hell she's been doing and like how she keeps going behind a tree to check one on her brother. Like that'd be a good series to watch, you know, just her story. Hisa's story, you know, just like it always ends with her like running up to a tree after a crazy day of adventuring of 30 minutes. And then you're just like, I wonder what she's doing. And the people who've watched Yoshihiko are like, oh, that's when they're doing that. You know, I'd finish Yoshihiko if I knew that was going to be a thing. Maybe.
Yeah, so the question now is, we have 3 episodes left. Should we just do them?
You know what? I think our listeners should tell us by sending some email at podcast@fancyramen.com.
I think well, we may as the, well. And
yeah, the catch with getting email feedback is that then we have to put out a PSA on if the email feedback says don't do it or do it.
Exactly. So we'd have to wait a week when we could just watch it and be done with it. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.